can't help thinking that somewhere in the universe there has to be something better than man. Has to be.
The words are Charlton Heston's.
Get out a last signal to Earth and we've landed.
The world he finds out in the galaxy will challenge every idea you've ever had of civilization. A planet where man is the lowest order of living things, and the superior beings are apes. They build the cities, make the laws, the gods, and control the guns that hunt a race of lowly, terrified humans who run wild in the jungles, are caged in the prisons, and stuffed in the museums. 20th Century Fox transforms the motion picture screen into Planet of the Apes. Pierre Boulle's finest novel since Bridge on the River Kwai.
The world gone insane. An upside-down civilization that could not be real. Yes, a world of madness and terror.
Man has no understanding. He can be taught a few simple tricks, nothing more. You did it. You cut up his brain, you bloody baboon! It's a man! It's a man!
Did not end here. It ended in an episode so unpredictable, so shocking, that it made the horror which preceded it seem calm and gentle as a summer's night. A great many people worked long and hard to answer the question of what a civilization would be like where the evolutionary process had been reversed and apes were the superior species. Hundreds of technicians and the largest number of makeup artists ever assembled assisted the producers, the writers, the director, the cast, Dr. Cornelius, Roddy McDowell, Dr. Zira, as played by Kim Hunter, Dr. Zayas, as portrayed by Maurice Evans, and Nova, by Linda Harrison.
Now the tribunal has placed you in my custody for final disposition. You realize what that means?
No.
Emasculation to begin with. An experimental surgery on the speech centers, on the brain. Eventually a kind of living death.
Planet of the Apes, beyond your wildest dreams.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week to talk about the one, the only, the classic, the immortal, Planet of the Apes, is our pal, host of Radio vs. the Martians and Podcast of La Vista Baby, Mike Gillis. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
Now, from what I understand, this is your favorite movie of all time, right? Planet of the Apes is your all-time favorite?
Unquestionably, my favorite movie of all time. I have kind of a rotating top 10 where things will move up, things will move down the top 10, but this one is just cemented as number one.
Now, when did you first see it?
Oh God, I think I must have seen it. Actually, I used to stay summers at my grandma's house that my sister and I didn't get along when we were little kids. So during summer vacation, there would be a week where one of us would stay at home and the other one would stay with our grandmother for a week. And my grandmother had this magical thing in her house, and it was called cable television. And it wasn't something that we had at home. And I think the first time I saw Planet of the Apes is one of those cable marathons they would do throughout a week where they'd play all five films one every night. And I don't know which one I saw first, though I probably have to admit the first time I saw anything apes related was probably the end of Spaceballs. But this movie, the first time I really saw these, was that cable marathon. And something kind of stuck in my head. And it wasn't until I saw a cable marathon of it years later that HBO was doing in the late 90s when my house finally did have cable, that I got sort of obsessed with these films. I think it must have been the 30th anniversary, because I know I went out and got the 30th anniversary VHS box set that was coming out. I think it was 1998, so VHS was still a thing. And I just kind of devoured that box set backwards and forwards.
It's funny to think about that. Back then, there weren't that many film franchises that had five installments. So they were kind of limited. If some station wanted to do five installments, you had like the Thin Man movies and, you know, James Bond, I guess, if you could afford those. And like, I remember growing up, one channel used to run the Blondie movies. There's like 27 Blondie movies. They ran those. But I mean, Planet of the Apes is, you know, still fairly unique at the time that there were five installments of this franchise. Now, we will cover the other films later on in other episodes of the show because they all deserve their own little chance to shine because they're all crazy in their own way. But this original one, I feel like this is one of these movies that is so good that even if you don't like the sequels, I feel like they don't color your view of this film. I mean, I feel that this, everybody knows the ending to this movie. The ending to me completely still works, even though you know what happened afterwards. It's so good that it just doesn't, I don't ever think about that. Oh, well, we see Taylor again in the next film. I just saw the movie again on the big screen last week, thanks to Cinemark. And you did too, right?
Yeah, I saw it twice on the big screen.
Why? Was that your first chance?
That's how big of a nerd I am for this thing. Oh, yeah, I saw it on the Sunday, the 24th of July, and then the 27th on a Wednesday night. So I went back again.
Now, was that the first time you've ever seen them, right, on the big screen?
On the big screen, yes. Well, not the first time seeing it, but definitely the first time on the big screen. Right. And I saw that popped up on Facebook on the AMC's big classic, or TMC's big classic movie thing. And I'm like, I have to see this on the big screen. And it's kind of cool that we're getting a chance, you know, in this age where they were just flooded with new things, that there's still space in theaters to see classics like this, because I don't know if I've had an opportunity to ever see this on the big screen before. And it was my first time seeing this at anything larger than just a television set.
Yeah, the film, God, it holds up so well. It's amazing. When I watched it again on Sunday, one of the things that occurred to me, and in preparation for us talking about it, was I feel like there were three reasons why this film could never be remade. And, of course, it's been remade in other forms. But, I mean, literally this film could never be made today is the beginning, the middle, and the end. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, it's like the beginning. This film takes a half hour before any apes show up, which is pretty remarkable. But how much time we spend with Taylor and the other two astronauts of them just sort of exploring. And I think in a lot of other films that might be considered boring and all that stuff would be cut. It would probably be like a 5-minute sequence. But you really get a chance to get to know these guys. And so when the big switcheroo comes in the cornfield, it really carries quite a wallop because you've spent a good amount of time with these guys.
Absolutely. I think it also gives you a chance to build up who Taylor is before he's a captive and before he spends at least a half an hour of the movie being mute against his will because he gets shot in the throat early on into this movie and is unable to speak for a good portion of it. And you get to see who he is and what it is that, you know, caused him to go into space in the first place. So that the interaction that he has with the apes actually has a greater amount of impact, because that's one of my favorite things about this movie is it's essentially the story of a total misanthrope, this jaded, angry dude who I kind of think of Colonel George Taylor, the Heston character, is being sort of the anti-Captain Kirk in a lot of ways. That Captain Kirk ultimately is this optimistic, idealistic person. Him and Kirk share a lot in common, which is that they're both men of action who can give big dramatic speeches, but when it comes down to it, you know, they can bust out the fisticuffs and beat, you know, kick some ass. And what sort of separates them is that ultimately when you see those old episodes of Star Trek and Captain Kirk goes into speech mode, he's ultimately reaffirming the human race and say, yes, we've been these things in the past. And yes, we have to overcome our own, you know, self-destructive natures and stuff. But, you know, we choose to be this and we choose to be this better thing. And that's not Taylor at all. That Taylor hates the human race. That Captain Kirk went into space to find these greater things and to bring human culture to aliens and alien culture to humans and create this greater new thing. George Taylor went into space because he hated humanity, saw us as stupid and self-destructive and bigoted and prejudiced and superstitious and just said, you know what? I'm done. I'm getting onto a rocket for a one-way trip into space, and I don't want to see any of you people ever again. And I figure whatever I found out there, whatever that is that's in space, is going to be better than what I left behind. So bye-bye. And ultimately, the beautiful irony of this movie is he's put into a situation where he has to be the advocate and the defender of the human race to a villain who has a philosophy which is frighteningly close to his own at the beginning of the movie.
It is a,
and yeah. That to me, I think, is the real punch of this movie.
And then, of course, you know, again, we're jumping to the end again, but I mean, like, his cynicism is only reaffirmed by the end of the film. I mean, he goes through that enormous change where, as you say, he becomes the defender of humanity, and then everything that he thought about humanity in the beginning of the film is confirmed when he sees what he sees at the end.
I mean, absolutely.
Enormously downbeat, you know, kind of. I mean, his opening, one of his opening lines, as you said, is like, he's like, I leave the human race with no regrets, you know. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
And he spends a lot of time really being the alpha male to Landon and Dodge, although not so much Dodge. Dodge doesn't say a lot. Dodge seems more interested in looking at plants and stuff. But he really rides Landon quite heavily.
Oh, God.
You know,
yeah,
I mean,
he spends 20 minutes just bullying this other astronaut who in many ways is the Captain Kirk. That is the golden boy, is the hero, the guy who went into space and, you know, that two-fisted, you know, square-jawed guy who went into space to be Captain Kirk. And actually, it's kind of funny about the three astronauts at the beginning is you could see them as sort of being the Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. Except in this chance, you know, McCoy is in charge. You know, the sort of passionate, angry guy rather than the sort of square-jawed hero. And, of course, you know, Dodge is sort of their Mr. Spock, who's more interested in, like you said, looking at plants and analyzing soil samples. And but yeah, he just rides this guy and just said, you do know what you signed on for, right? That you're not going to get actually any of this glory that you think you're going to get. Everyone you know is dead. They're all gone. It's dust. And even if you could get back, what is his line? You'd look like something that fell out of a tree.
Yeah. The statue of you is all green and nobody can read it anymore. Yeah, he's really brutal. To poor Landon,
yeah.
And I have to wonder what that ride was like across space before Landon and the other guys got into the sleep containment. I mean, it must have just been, I don't want to spend this much time with this guy, but, you know, he must have been happy to be like, I'm going to go in my cryo sleep now, for the love of God. I can't stand talking to you. You're just not fun to be around. And, of course, there is the fourth astronaut, which is Stewart, who dies in transit. And I, you know, this film is directed by Franklin Schaffner, one of the great directors, kind of an unsung director, really, considering his filmography. I mean, he's got Planet of the Apes, Patton, Papillon. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the great movies of all time. He previously worked with Charlton Heston on The Warlord, which is apparently the thing that sort of got him this gig. But, I mean, that shot of Stewart where we see the reveal that she died in transit because of the glass cracked, I love that. Mm-hmm. I love that just the screech on the sound effect that they give you.
Yes.
And the close up of her sort of dried away corpse. It's like that's an incredibly powerful kind of it's very 60s-ish kind of
jarring.
Cut. Yeah, very jarring. And it's Schaffner was not one of these guys that you would call like a visionary, which, you know, which is a really overused word nowadays when we're talking about directors, because good Lord, they call Zack Snyder a visionary. But I mean, he was somebody that applied his. He applied whatever his style was to the story as it needed it. And the Planet of the Apes has kind of a mod, very 60s way of cutting and a way of – and yet it doesn't feel dated. You know what I mean?
No.
I think you can tell that it's a 60s movie, but it doesn't – I don't know. It's not like it's a you know, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls or anything. It feels very contemporary. I guess maybe that's because it takes place in the future and to a certain extent.
Far future of 1972.
Is that really?
And eventually, you know, the 40th century. Yes.
Yes. Huh.
Remember, he says at the very beginning of the movie that he is going into space and that they've been in space for 6 months and they're about to go into deep sleep. And he looks down at the chronometer. There's the current time of us. You know, this is the time of the universe. And this is the relative time for us. And for us, 6 months is in the year 1972.
Oh, my Lord. I don't think I've ever noticed that. 1972. Oh, my God.
So they're like, it's one of those near future things, kind of like On the Beach is one of those near future things that is made in the late 50s, but takes place in, you know, 2 years in the future. So I think this is one of those where apparently in 1968, even though we're just about to land on the moon, we're just on the verge of just under the speed of light travel, that it's going to happen real fast. That also notice that it's not NASA on his patch. It's ANSA.
Yeah.
Because I think you probably would have had to get the rights. ANSA. So they can't be NASA. But it's kind of a, maybe an alternate secret government. I've read a lot of Planet of the Apes expanded universe stuff.
Oh, boy.
And, of course, as soon as you have stuff like that, people latch onto that and write whole books about it. So,
interesting.
But so, it's neat little touches like that. But
yeah. They land on the planet, of course, and then they wander around. And then we get to the big moment. Well, I mean, first of all, they go skinny dipping. We get to see some naked butts in a G-rated movie, which is kind of remarkable.
Yes.
So then they go swimming, and then they meet the humans. And I love Taylor's oh-so-snotty comment of, this is the best they've got when 6 months we'll be running this place. Which is very, very nice. And then is the big reveal. One of the great reveals, I would say, in film history. As we see, like, the, you know, somebody stalking the humans in the cornfields, and we see those whips coming down, and then we see the apes on the horseback, and you combine it with the music with I think it's Jerry Goldsmith,
yes,
the music, yeah, and those horns, the ram's horn, that is really, that still carries an amazing punch, considering how many times, I mean, I've seen this movie dozens of times, but it still is so, there's something about the way the apes ride into the frame and then turn around.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's remarkable.
Oh, yeah. And the ram's horn hits just as they turn around, and it cuts to the other apes' faces and then to Heston's mind-breaking, which is just, he's like, he's got nothing at that moment. I kind of love it because he's this guy who always has something to say, and he has nothing in that moment. And that's actually some of the stuff that's great in the soundtrack by Jerry Goldsmith is that it's these moments where you're not sure if it's sound effects or if it's the soundtrack, because he would incorporate a lot of Foley art into the soundtrack, the ram's horns. There's like these mixing bowls and these weird sounds, especially during the hunt scene. But that's the thing too, with that big screeching sound of the water coming into the side of their ship, right as we see Stewart at the beginning. I'm not sure if that's soundtrack or sound effect, because those things mix so well together in this movie that you don't really know which one it is, that it's all part of one experience. It's probably the most, I guess you could say, fully incorporated score and Foley track that I've seen in almost any movie.
It's
where you're not really
well
sure what is what. The sound effect, yeah, exactly. The sound effects are the music, and the music are the sound effect.
Yeah. So then, of course, Taylor gets captured. They all get captured, and they get dragged back. And as you mentioned, Taylor gets shot in the neck, which renders him silent for a while. And then that's when we meet this whole world. And, of course, I mean, most people probably know at this point of it, the original script was going to have the apes living in a very futuristic society. And then they realized, budget-wise, they couldn't do that. So then they put them in a much more primitive, where they're on horses and they're dragging carts around. And they live like, basically, they look like they live in Tatooine, for the most part, with those huts and the things called that. But I mean, the visual ideas presented in this middle sequence of the film, again, is remarkable in that it looks completely real. I mean, I guess if you want to, you know, examine it close, you could say, it's a little Land of the Losty with its sort of fakeness. But I don't know. To me, it looks plausible. I maybe that's not the right word, but it seems completely real to me that these creatures live and the way they dress. It all looks right to me.
I think it's a consistent-looking world, and that's what makes it work. It's like when you watch the reboot of Battlestar Galactica. One of the things I like best about that show is you notice all pieces of paper and books have the corners cut off, and it's that little touch that's consistent through the entire series that I think Planet of the Apes has absolutely, too, that this is the way that apes read. They have these scrolls that they carry around. This is what ape doors look like. This is the technology they have, which is kind of weirdly anachronistic, where they don't have electricity, but they have running water. They have the ability to have like a fire hose in the cages. They have a camera during the end of the hunt scene. And those are all little things that you would go, well, that's a little weird they would develop that, but it actually plays into the reveal at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
That, of course, some of this technology will survive and be reinterpreted and will survive where other stuff has to be sort of recreated from scratch. But it feels like a lived-in world. It has this consistency to it that you can see things like when Heston escapes and, you know, Taylor is running through Ape City and he actually comes across this funeral, that they could have very easily just made it look exactly the way that a human funeral does. But the casket has this weird sort of wood-paneled shaped look to it that was made for this movie. They could have just used a regular casket and go, yeah, it's the same like a human casket. But no. they give it this specific look that's very much particular to this world and this culture that we've been thrown into. So the ape world looks like something that you have these sort of designs and these clothing, and everything is sort of built around this world. And I think it's also what helps make this movie a lot more timeless, because it doesn't feel like the 1970s is smeared all over the future. It feels like a very specific world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, of course, part of the reason I think it does work so well is, as has been celebrated, the makeup really kicks in at that point. John Chambers, who won a special Oscar for the Planet of the Apes makeup. I mean, we are introduced to Roddy McDowall and
Kim Hunter.
Kim Hunter, of course, from Streetcar Named Desire. And it's funny. I mean, not that Taylor disappears through the movie, but of course, once he's muted, he can't help but be set aside a little, and the apes become the primary characters in the middle. And, you know, boy, they are both really tremendous, both McDowell and Hunter in these roles. I mean, it doesn't take too long to just completely forget that you're looking at apes talking, and you're just completely into that they are characters. They completely inhabit those roles, and I think that's probably why they went for really decent actors, as opposed to having to get, I mean, you wouldn't want to get a big star anyway, because you're going to bury them in ape makeup. But I mean, there's something about the way that they just took command of those roles. And I don't think anymore that these are apes talking, and they just seem like a couple that are arguing about how to get out of this pickle that they find themselves in, because obviously they realize as scientists that there is something worth investigating here, but they also know they could most likely lose their jobs and maybe even their lives if they push it further.
That's what I really like about Cornelius and Zira, is they actually are my favorite fictional couple. That I love these characters. I love their place in this movie, and I also love their interactions with each other. I think that they have this wonderfully sweet but also realistic relationship. You know, you can tell seeing them interact with each other why they love each other. You can see what it is that they get out of this relationship with each other. That they're both very intellectual, they're both very curious, but they're also in a very repressive culture where it's probably not easy to find somebody who's willing to be those things openly. I mean, Zira is, because Zira is just a firebrand that if she sees some kind of injustice in the world, she will not stop until it's changed. Where Cornelius is a bit more of a fraidy cat, where he'll have those conversations in private with her, but he's very kind of conscious of the consequences that could come from pushing it too far. And the kind of back and forth you have between the two of them, where I think he gives her a sense of stability and she also gives him a bit more backbone. So they're kind of good for each other in that way. I think they moderate each other and make each other better. And you sort of see those interactions. And that's one of the cool things, is it's kind of an unusual role for Heston, because, you know, what is Heston really known for is his voice.
Yeah.
And this presence. And he spends a good half hour of this movie not talking to anyone and having to essentially on purpose be a fly on the wall and having to listen and sort of spy on people. And they have these very candid conversations in front of him because, and you know, human beings in this time are these mute, dumb beasts. It's like, think of the conversations you've had in front of your cat before.
Yeah.
Because you don't worry about your cat blabbing to anybody, because right. You don't understand that. Well, your cat probably doesn't understand most of what I'm saying. And it's him kind of absorbing that, so that it changes the dynamic again the minute he gets his throat heals enough and he can speak again.
It's interesting. It's that this film, I think, again, if it would have been made today, I think by the time we get to the second chunk of the movie, the second third, or the middle part, that we would have to have some action scenes. I think they would feel like we would need it to pump people up. But the whole middle section is really just sort of a philosophical debate. I mean, for God's sakes, they put Taylor on trial. I am jumping around a little, that they do have the action scene where he's chased and whatever, and that leads to another big reveal where he can talk. But I mean, it really is just a lot of philosophical debating about society, the ape society. And that's, you know, again, that's a remarkable thing for a sci-fi movie to be that talky and to not be boring, to be interesting, and to be like, yeah, this is, you know, it really is sort of a fascinating idea that this is a very strict world. I mean, we should mention Maurice Evans as Dr. Zaius is remarkable in this movie. He's tremendous. You know,
he's one of the best movie villains of all time.
Yeah. I mean, he's one of those things where it's like he knows more than he's letting on, but he wants to protect his planet. He wants to protect his people. And so there's the scene of where Taylor's in the cage and he scrawls out hell. What does he scrawl out in the dirt? His name, right? Does he write
I
Taylor?
Can, oh, you. He writes, I can write.
I can write.
On
and
the
then,
ground.
Yeah, and Zaius just smushes it with the stick to cover it up. And you're like, oh, wow. You know, like, it's such an amazing thing. So then, of course, Taylor gets freed. He runs around, and he gets, that's when he sees the fact that he runs into, he sees, what's his name? Burton has been stuffed.
And oh, yeah. Dodge.
Dodge, I'm sorry, not Burton, yeah. Which is a really grim moment to see poor Dodge with his eyes all white. And they've got that pasty thing. I was like, ooh, that's pretty damn grim. And then,
yeah,
of course,
that is horrifying.
Yeah, and then that leads to the second big reveal, which is Taylor in the net yelling, get your paws off me, you damn dirty ape, which is, again, when punctuated with that music. And then I love that as soon as that big close-up happens of Taylor yelling that, they cut to the apes looking shocked, and then there is a pull-away, an establishing shot of just... Like, and that's Schaffner saying, okay, this world of the apes is never going to be the same again. They have now been rocked with some piece of news that they are not going to be able to deal with because now they know a human can talk.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, you think about, you know, every so often you see in the news that some animal escapes and is rampaging through something. It's like a moose or something is running through some Alaska town and you see footage of the cops trying to catch it or corral it. Imagine if they threw a net over it and it just started screaming at them. I mean, that would be insane. That your whole perception of this world, and another big part of it, and this plays into Dr. Zaius too, why is this such a shocking moment? Because, I mean, humans and apes don't look that different. I mean, of course, one has fur, one doesn't, and, you know, one of them never talks, one does, but you imagine that there'd be sort of that perception, I mean, we have with apes in our time that you can teach them sign language and there's an intelligence there. But you don't get that in this future because it is very explicit and it's very intentional that the state and Dr. Zaius and this culture that's built up around this is built on a lie that is designed to stop people from asking that question. That they don't want people in, you know, looking too deeply into human anatomy. They don't want people looking too deeply into the past because they don't want the revealed ever to come out that these things are capable of speech. And that's the thing I love about Dr. Zaius as a character is that oftentimes when you have these sorts of characters who are built on, I'm part of this repressive regime, you know, like a 1984 Orwell sort of thing, and I'm trying to prevent the truth from getting out and I will torture and kill people to protect that big lie, they're often just complete moral monsters. And what I love about Zaius is that Dr. Zaius is somebody who clearly sees himself as the hero of this movie. That society is fraying at the edges and he's the only person stopping it from descending into chaos. That if human beings are understood to have been, even have the potential for rational thought and, you know, no pun intended, humanity, that we could see them as something other than a dumb animal that digs through your garbage and ravages our crops, well, people might start treating them well. People might feel a sense of guilt for gorillas going out with rifles on horses and just hunting them for sport, or the horrible experimentations that doctors are doing on them, the just brain surgery, you just pull them in, jab them with needles, cut out their brain, whatever, that if we see they could potentially be people, then that all stops. That there's no way. That starts a whole moral conversation about how we treat these creatures, where it's clear Dr. Zaius just wants them exterminated. And if we have that conversation and we start treating them better, what if they start clawing their way out of barbarism? And again, the big reveal of the movie that we're on a planet that was once run by human beings who destroyed themselves. What if they could come back and do it again and for real this time? And that's a thing Dr. Zaius cannot allow. Also, the idea of just stopping science from moving forward, the idea of at that one point where Taylor is explaining to them, you know, that I came out of the sky on a ship. And notice the sort of dogmatic retort that even an intellectual like Cornelius has. Flight is a scientific impossibility. He doesn't even entertain it. And he's a scientist. I mean, he's, by the standards of his culture, he's a radical. And even he has that deeply ingrained in him. You just can't do that. That doesn't work. Dr. Zaius, too, when they say, oh, the paper airplane, it's a toy. It floats on the air. He doesn't try it. He just crumples it right away. Mm-hmm. Because he knows. And I can't allow this stuff. And I think on one level, if the apes are allowed to get anything past this weird kind of frozen in amber culture of everything staying exactly the same, what if we become like the humans? What if we develop the bombs that destroyed this world? And it's like he thinks that the only way to keep us all alive and keep us safe is to maintain this lie that this culture is only this old. It's blasphemy to ask questions about it or to question these things in our history and our religion. You cannot ask those questions. We shut it down. We pull your funding. We throw you in jail or disappear you if you push too hard in that direction. We don't let you develop new technology. We won't let you ask too many hard questions about these humans other than just cutting out their brains. And it's like this balancing act that this guy has to have because he believes that it's the only way to stop his species, his people, from killing themselves. And it's kind of fascinating because in many ways, if you make him the main character of this movie, Taylor is the villain.
It's an interesting idea. But yeah, I mean, it's funny that Zaius, if he wanted to, really could have just killed Taylor early on. I mean, I know that he is where there is some level of that there is, some part of ape society is going to rebel at that. But I feel like he could have done it on the sly and nobody would have known. I mean, look what they did to, what's his name? Landon. I mean, that scene's brutal. That turn of where you see him and the way that actor's just sort of staring off in the space. Again, I don't know how this movie got rated G. I mean, it's pretty friggin' intense. But I mean, like, there's that scene with Taylor and Zaius alone, where he calls him Taylor, and Taylor says, "That's the first time you've called me by my name." And he's like, "Thank you," you know. And I have always sort of wondered why Zaius doesn't just have him killed then and there.
I wonder. I get the impression that he thinks that Taylor is part of a strain of human beings on the other side of the Forbidden Zone, you know, that huge irradiated desert. I think he's afraid there's more of them and they may be coming. And I get the impression the thing that probably saved Taylor in the first place was that his throat was damaged and he couldn't speak. And I think that's why they quickly finished off Landon, that they caught him and he must have been talking right away. And they're like, bah, yeah. Lobotomize him. So the fact that, Charlton Heston, who's a guy who never shuts up in movies because he has this great, theatrical voice, was saved by the fact that he was wounded. I imagine they probably would have killed him too. But I think at that point, Zaius might have been in a place where, clearer heads are sort of prevailing. And I need to get, intelligence out of this guy. Are there more of you? Do I need to be afraid? Do we need to deal with this situation? I can't just kill you all one by one as you come, because what if you start coming in numbers that I can't just kill one by one? Mm.
What did you think about Linda Harrison as Nova? We haven't mentioned
her
yet.
Somebody who... I mean, she was basically the girlfriend of a producer,
right.
So she wasn't an actor, and I think she did a great job, because she really kind of comes across acting the way you see, like, an animal act, the way she acts in fear, you can see her understand things, but she can't articulate, but there's moments, it's kind of like watching a deer or, like, a cat or something that it hears a sound, and it's like, ah, and you hear it, you see it tense up and ready to flee. And I think she did a good job. I mean, given the fact that she doesn't have any dialogue, that she can't emote in the way that you expect an actor to, and she's basically playing an intelligent animal, I think she did a great job.
Yeah, she has very big eyes. I mean, she's certainly easy to look at. I'm sure that had something to do with why she was the wife of, like, a Hollywood producer. She was certainly quite easy on the eyes and the fur bikini and everything like that. So, yeah, I mean, she's a good foil for Heston. It's sort of funny, his sort of casual sexism.
You're not as smart as Stewart, but you're the only girl in town.
Yeah, the only girl in town. When I saw that in the theater, that got more than a couple of laughs at that sort of casual. And then Heston's line about Stewart was going to be our new Eve with our hot and eager help. A little too much detail from Taylor.
That sounds like a more miserable job than Landon had, which is basically to be the group whipping boy.
Which makes no sense, because wouldn't you send along more women than the men? Not less women.
You'd think.
Stewart can only pump out one kid at a time.
You're not going to get a breeding population with four people anyways. Yeah. I mean, even if you did half men, half women. All you really need to do is have one horrible accident and everyone's dead. I mean, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. But it's one of those things you just kind of go. I mean, at the beginning of the movie, Taylor is smoking a cigar inside of a spaceship.
Yeah.
So... You were like, how, what? And it's like, I'm pretty sure this is before, you know, smoking was banned on airplanes, but it just, man, it, maybe it's just a sign that, you know, the filters that we have in the air for spaceships just got really good. Or maybe he's just an asshole and he just doesn't care. And because he's in charge, he can get away with it. Because, well, it's not like they can report him to their bosses, yeah. Because they're now like 2,000 years in the future and how many light years away.
I think that's,
there's no HR
scenario.
You can go to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think more likely that Taylor's just being a dick. He's just like, whatever, do what I want. So,
I was just going to say, it's kind of a cool subversive casting to get Heston in the first place. I know that he's actually the reason this movie got made, because right. Nobody wanted to touch this thing until, you know, they got a big star had signed on to it. I mean, Charlton Heston was the thing that moved the needle and got them the funding to make this movie. But I think it's a really neat subversive piece of casting, because what do we know Charlton Heston primarily for? These big biblical epics where he's like this square-jawed, righteous hero. Things like Ben-Hur, things like the Ten Commandments, where he's just gooder than good and larger than life. And you have him playing this just total cynic who just hates people and is just needling his subordinates on this spaceship. And it really works that he has all of the gravitas of Heston, but he doesn't have the optimism of a lot of his other characters or the righteousness. He's just such a dick. And that's what I think makes this movie work so well, is that it's about that dick having to defend the very thing that he hates and having to kind of pull himself out of this nosedive of his attitude of, you know, about the human race and are, you know, maybe we aren't so bad. And then at the very end, having his head chopped off right under that and just going, yep, no, it's exactly what you thought. It's really that bad. And I think it just works. It's one of the few movies where the villain gets the philosophical high ground and wins, that he wins the argument. That, you know, again, the Captain Kirk comparison. There's so many episodes where Captain Kirk wins the philosophical debate when he gives a big speech. In this case, it goes the other way where, you know, at the very end of the movie, he's got his freedom. He's not going to be cut open. It looks like Cornelius and Zira have been acquitted. It looks like he's going to ride off into the sunset and try to figure out what this planet is. And Dr. Zaius has Cornelius read him this piece of scripture that is all about, you know, what monsters the human race is. It's actually one of the few prayers I have memorized. And it's, beware the beast man, for he is the devil's pawn. Alone among God's primates, he kills for hunt, for sport, or lust, or greed. Yea, he will murder his brother to possess his murder. He will murder his brother to possess his brother's land. Let him not breed in great numbers, for he will make a desert of his home and yours. Shun him. Drive him back into his jungle lair, for he is a harbinger of death. And you see Heston, and Taylor has no answer for this. He has nothing. He has no retort. He doesn't have his thing that reaffirms that, yes, we have these things in our nature that are ugly and horrible, but we can overcome them. No, he has no answer to that. He has nothing. And he rides off, and Dr. Zaius is ultimately right. And it's, I mean, he was ultimately right. The he at the beginning of the movie. And it's just a punch in the gut.
Yeah, Zaius is actually fairly kind to him. And when they go to the cave and they visit and they find the doll that can talk. And I mean, they reveal all this stuff. And when Zaius says, you may not like what you find, it's easier to read that line with more weight than it normally have, because you know what's coming. But that, yeah. The way they let it just hang in the air, if I was Taylor, I mean, I'm sure that my curiosity, well, what am I saying? If I had landed on the Planet of the Apes, I would have been lobotomized early on. There's no doubt about that. But if I had been Taylor, I don't know if my curiosity would get the better of me. I would think I'd be a little scared by hearing Zay say, you know, you may not like what you find. Maybe I'd just go live in a cave with Nova and just, you know, make the best of it.
That's really the best you can make of it. I mean, there really is nothing else. And it gets weirder in the sequels, but based on just what we have in this first movie, you know, the best you can do is try to find a nice quiet place where there's enough plants that you can eat something and aren't being hunted by gorillas on horseback with rifles, and just try to live out the rest of your life. But I mean, this is I've had this argument with friends before, this debate about, you know, what is the worst future to be sent to? Would you rather be sent to the Planet of the Apes, or would you rather be in the Terminator future? And I really don't have a good answer. These are both pretty terrible.
So, I mean, yes, yeah, so Taylor wanders out, and as he gets closer. Now, something I found on IMDb, which is sort of interesting, they said if you base it upon where Taylor, of course, ends up, because we sees the, you know, spoiler alert, finds the Statue of Liberty, and he realizes he's been home all along. Now, based on where the Statue of Liberty is found, most people assume that the good chunk of Planet of the Apes takes place in New Jersey. Which, you know, considering some of the things that have gone on here, I'm not terribly surprised. It's not the most shocking thing in the world to realize that that's what it would become. But, I mean, so, yeah, and the reveal of that scene is so perfect. I mean, not only is the idea perfect, and all credit in the world belongs to Rod Serling, because I believe it was Rod Serling that came up with that of the ending, which certainly seems like something he would have come up with, because as mega fan of Planet of the Apes, comedian Dana Gould says, Planet of the Apes is just basically a giant Twilight Zone episode, you know, a really good one. But
absolutely.
And so it certainly came up with that amazing ending. But I mean, again, the way it's composed is perfect, is the way that as we see Taylor approach, there's these weird spires in the foreground, and they're draped in sort of shadow, and we can't really tell what we're looking at. It's really just the perfect reveal. I mean, I might say, I don't know, would you argue this is probably the greatest final scene in movie history? It's certainly top five.
Oh, absolutely top five. And I don't think it loses its power when you go into it knowing, because one of the things of the Planet of the Apes that I think makes it a unique, you know, piece of popular culture, I think it's up there with Soylent Green, where also a Heston sci-fi movie.
Yep.
That more people know that final shot than the other hour and 40 minutes of the movie. That we know the reveal. So it's almost impossible for any human being to go into this movie not knowing that we're on Earth the whole time. And I think it doesn't hurt it at all. I mean, you get the shock taken away from you, but you also realize how well constructed it is to hide you from that reveal. Like one of the things at the beginning when they're spending the 20 minutes just going through this deserted, destroyed world that you don't realize at the time is, again, you know, melted, irradiated New Jersey that has just been turned into a desert. They actually make a remark about how they can't get any readings with the, you know, there's no astronomical, you know, constellations they can look at because there's a weird cloud cover at night and we can't see the moon. I mean, these are all things that if you were able to see those things, you recognize the moon right away. We've seen it so many times in our life that you have to put that stuff up there to hide you from the fact that we are on planet Earth. And also, the lack of moon made this, you know, tell you why the shoreline is in a very different place than it was before. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why the Statue of Liberty is buried. And, you know, who knows? There's a lot of expanded universe stuff about the, you know, the change in the planet. And I don't know if that patch of Ape City, I don't know how big that green area is. But is the rest of the world completely destroyed? Is it almost all desert except for that? I don't know. But it's kind of terrifying to think that there's just this tiny little speck of land that, I don't know, maybe the size of New Jersey, that is the only thing you can live in. And then there's a bunch of apes there, so they're not really willing to share their crops with you. So it's pretty bad place to land.
And it said that I love the fact that it's Nova that who we see it through, really. Because it's the final shot is her. As she is looking down at Taylor and he's yelling, God damn you, God damn you all to hell. And of course, apparently the censors, the movie censors wanted to give the film a better, like a PG or something because he said, God damn. And they argued saying, well, he's not using it as a curse word. He's literally asking God to damn humanity. And so they apparently got it through again. It's a G-rated movie with all this violence and nudity and all these stuff. This is a G-rated movie. But I mean that shot of Nova just looking sort of baffled at Taylor as to why is he flipping out, and then for her to look up at this thing, and just that long pan shot, and then for there's no music, and we just hear the lapping waves of the shore over the credits. It is just such a gut punch, and I mean, obviously, I didn't see it in the original. I can only imagine what that must have been like to see that in a time in, you know, 1968, there were no such thing as spoiler alerts. Nobody cared about that stuff. You just went to see the movie. Mm-hmm. What that impact must have been like. That just must have been startling.
But also, it was a movie that was made during the height of the Cold War.
Yeah.
And I know that you've had this discussion on with, I don't know if just this show, but in others, but I know Michael Bailey has talked about, you know, growing up during the tail end of the Cold War and the threat, you know, the overhanging sort of Damocles of nuclear war being there and being something that you were genuinely afraid of. That when you read something like Watchmen or a lot of things like On the Beach or any of these other movies that are built around this idea of this impending doom, this idea that it's completely plausible that the human race might wipe itself out in the course of a day using the weapons that we'd built to, you know, keep ourselves safe. And it seems like such a weird, distant thing now, the idea of nuclear war. But this movie came out at the height of it. It was only a couple of years after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I mean, that was a thing, too, even in Star Trek, the idea of nuclear war, that a lot of people forget that Star Trek is a post-apocalyptic. It's a post-apocalyptic story about the human race having wiped itself out almost in a Third World War and pulling itself out and making itself better and overcoming that. And that's the carrot, and Planet of the Apes is the stick. It's the one that says, you know, this is what will happen to you if we don't get our act together. If we don't stop being so violent and self-destructed and short-sighted and racist and horrible, this is what's going to become of us. We're going to become a bunch of dumb beasts hunted for sport. Where Star Trek is saying the opposite with the same, you know, message and philosophy of we need to get over this. But they're saying, look how much nicer our stuff could be if we could move past this. Where Planet of the Apes is saying, you know, or else. This is what we could be. So we need to stop right now. And I think that, you know, that sort of impending doom hanging over, it really created a lot of really great science fiction.
So, yeah, in regards to the ending, again, which is one of the great endings of all time. I mean, like, when you saw it for the first time, do you remember when you saw that end? Like, how did it work on you when you first saw it?
I don't know if I remember the first time I saw it. I think I probably saw parodies of it, whether Spaceballs or on The Simpsons and a number of other places, because it's one of those endings that is just permeated throughout our entire pop culture. And I really don't know. I don't know when I saw it first. It still has an impact, I can say, even after watching it that many times. But I think it's less about the shocking reveal for me now as it is about watching Heston break, mm-hmm. watching this guy who had spent this whole movie getting, you know, his own rhetoric rubbed in his face, finally getting the upper hand and getting away, and then having it all crash down and having it just break. I really don't know. I know that it definitely still works, but I don't think it's ever been a surprise to me. I think that, again, you know, what is Soylent Green? I mean, you know the answer to that question.
It's right.
Usually the only thing anyone knows about that movie. But I think the ending just works. And I think, you know, spoilers be damned. I don't know if that even really matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it is part of the culture at this point. And that's something that's, that's the movie's ultimate sort of contribution to film culture is that scene. You know, and it's funny, when I've seen Planet of the Apes in the theater, I think three different times over the years. And you've probably read or heard about these things where there's this idea that, like, modern audiences don't know how to watch old movies because they just can't get in the mindset of what the context the film was made in. And so I've heard people, when Heston does his "God damn you all," that, like, people start kind of tittering a little bit because it's so big. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I ask you, how does any actor, what actor could handle a moment like that plausibly? You know what I mean? Most actors would not be able to say, okay, you're on an ape planet, and at the end of the movie, you see the Statue of Liberty, and you have to explain to the audience that everyone's home because you don't have anyone else to bounce off of because your co-star's a mute and you got a horse. I don't think Meryl Streep could have done that really effectively. So it's like, every time I hear somebody kind of giggle a little, I kind of get mad. Because it's like, no, Heston is perfect in the scene. It's just he's big because he has to be big. What are you going to go small? It's the worst thing any human could possibly ever learn. What do you expect from him? Of course that's his reaction.
Yeah, it's weird. I try to be patient with young people because I think... This is the part where I just start shaking my cane and talking about kids and their loud music. But a lot of it is just pacing is so different in movies. And what's so jarring to me is it feels, and I've said this to my co-host Casey Doran a lot, is that we were born at a really weird time at this crux of all these different big cultural changes. So we can exist in sort of the time before and the time after, but it's not always a perfect fit. We're sort of built for that sort of late 70s, early to mid 80s kind of world. And the pacing of movies is one of those places where you can feel that generational shift where I can watch something like Jaws or Empire Strikes Back and just be riveted by it. And then I see a younger person who's like, this is so boring. And I just don't understand it. You know, I don't understand it. Because it seems like maybe in the last 10, 15 years, pacing has gotten a lot faster where you just have to go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, have something constantly happening. But I like to believe that we have an attention span and that we want to watch something in a deeper way than something exploding and that we can handle. I mean, Jaws was a blockbuster. It was the biggest movie of its year. But I do pull my hair out a bit when I hear people, you know, to the degree I have hair, talking about, you know, this movie being so slow. And it's like, no, it's interesting. And I get that with Planet of the Apes, too, is there's also different styles of acting that are more prevalent. If you notice, fight styles that Charlton Heston kind of uses a Captain Kirk style stage fighting.
Yeah, they are very
in this movie.
Very roustabout type fight. Yeah, because he's not a trained fighter.
Cage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain kind of like guy, you know, punches at you and you dodge to the side and chop him on the back of the neck. That kind of move. I mean, it's all stuff that it's of its time, but there's bits of it that are timeless. And I think that, you know, one, there's context, but also I think kids need to learn how to enjoy things other than the thing that they grew up with. And I think that's how you broaden your horizon. This movie, I wasn't even a single-celled organism when this movie came out. And I can enjoy it and love it, and it's my favorite of all time. And I just think, I don't know, I think that when we lose our ability to watch something that didn't come out in our specific cultural context, our time period, that we really lose the ability to appreciate things that are older and different. And, you have to learn to like everything, you know, and it's, well, not everything, but more things. And, I don't know. I feel your pain, believe me. And it's that sort of thing too, is like, I don't know. Maybe I'm just hitting that age where it's just like, that frisbee comes over my fence. I'm keeping it. But I don't know.
I'm picturing
maybe we're just old.
I'm picturing like a little Dennis the Menace kid who's like, Mr. Gillen. You're just like shaking your fist at him and stuff.
That's weird. I've hit the age where I already start relating more to those characters. I don't know when it happened. When I was a little kid, you watch like Winnie the Pooh cartoons and you just think that Rabbit is this wet blanket and the stick in the mud. And then you hit this age where you're like, he just wants to have nice things. You just ate all his food and you ruined his door. Can you just leave him alone? And I don't know when that happened, but it happened to me, I think, earlier than it probably should.
Well, okay. That's a conversation for another time. But in terms of Planet of the Apes being your all-time favorite movie, do you have an idea why that's so? Like what it is? There's something about it that got under your skin more than some other movies, or do you have any idea why that is?
Well, I think it's a combination of it being all of these things that I really like. I've seen that before where something sounds exactly like I would love it on paper, but it doesn't work out. This is one of those examples where it does, where I have a movie that has time travel. It's got post-apocalyptic hellscapes. It's got guerrillas, armies, you know, on horseback, you know, hunting savage humans. It's got gunfights and courtroom drama, and it's got chases. It's got Charlton Heston screaming and debates on the nature of human rights and, you know, stuff about racism and slavery and arguments about the self-destructive nature of man and nuclear war and arguments about theocracy and freedom of speech, you know, the right to be different in a culture you're born in, and Charlton Heston screaming some more. I mean, this movie has like a combination of all these things that I really love, all kind of crammed up into a ball. but it doesn't seem like a weird pandery mess the way that some things that seem like they're built specifically for me can be. It just, every single one of those pieces serves a greater whole and serves a greater theme, and it just works on a rewatch. Because all of my favorite movies, I think they have to meet that, can I watch this 50 times criteria? That's the litmus test. Is this still something I get something out of after the third time? There's a lot of things, like, I really enjoyed Avengers Age of Ultron, but I'm probably not going to watch it again because I think I got everything out of it on that first watch.
Right.
Where Planet of the Apes, I'm probably going to watch this again and again till the day I die. I think it's going to be a movie I watch at least 100 more times because I'm always getting something out of it. I always have a different perspective based on my mood or where I am in my life, where, you know, things that I've experienced. And I think because it has all those different parts, I gravitate towards different parts of that movie. Like sometimes I just want to watch the courtroom scene where Taylor has to defend himself, or I just want to watch the hunt scene, you know, where the mute humans are running from the gorillas, or I just want to watch the scene in the cave at the end where they find the doll, or I just want to see a scene with Cornelius and Zira talking to a mute Heston as he's writing stuff down, and Cornelius is scoffing at him. I mean, every one of these parts, you know, there are movies where I just watch one scene over and over, but I watch all these scenes, sometimes individually, over and over again. And I don't know any other movie that I do that with.
Did you have any of the stuff when you were a kid? Or when you were, like, all the... I mean, this film is another, you know, groundbreaking in other ways in that this was one of the first... I mean, it's not... Okay, Planet of the Apes itself did not have a lot of merchandise. It was really that came with the sequels. But this really was sort of Star Wars before Star Wars in terms of that a studio realized, hey, people want to own Planet of the Apes dolls and Planet of the Apes trash can, and we can make a this and we can make that. Did you have any of that stuff?
I didn't until I was an adult. I think that I first encountered this movie when I was 10. It would have been the late 80s. So I think a lot of that stuff wasn't being made. It's a weird property as far as being a hardcore fan, because it's one that, even though it's been remade and rebooted twice, there are so many writers and artists who are fans of the original, so every so often there'll be this big resurgence of it, and a big resurgence of all these new action figures and all these new comic books and tie-in novels. I mean, they come out every so often, so it's the part of me that kind of scoffs at, you know, the Star Wars fans that were angry about their, you know, expanded universe being rebooted or thrown out. I'm like, dude, I've done that like four times, you know, just get over it. It means you get to revisit those same moments interpreted in a totally different way. Like in the second movie, the question of, well, how did Cornelius and Zira and, you know, Dr. Milo fix that ship? I've seen four different versions of that story. So, and every so often you get it. I know that Boom Studios currently has the comic book rights
right
to Planet of the Apes, and they've been doing an amazing job. You'd think that since they got those rights around the time that they made Dawn of the Planet of the Apes or Rise of the Planet of the Apes, that they would be making comic books primarily on that comic book universe, you know, based on those new movies. But they aren't. They're making them based on the classics. And they've put out some amazing stuff that has just been really, really good. The same thing, about every 10 years, somebody who loves this stuff but also knows how to write and draw rediscovers this thing, somebody buys the rights, and I get a whole new, you know, branch of action figures and stuff. Every anniversary, something comes out, I get something new. So I kind of get waves of it. And I think it's probably a good thing because it stops me from becoming a hoarder. And I don't have too yeah. much of this stuff. So I don't know. I think it's probably the perfect amount of merchandise you get. You get small, quick bursts of it, but then you get a break from it for a while. And then when you think there's nothing else you can enjoy about it, hey, there's a new Planet of the Apes novel, but at this time it's told the first movie through the perspective of Landon or Dr. Milo or an ape, you know, cop. There's been a lot of really good stuff they've put out on it. And actually, I've been kind of surprised how good the expanded universe stuff has been for the series.
I would imagine any book narrated by Landon probably stops very abruptly in the middle. Just
oh, yeah. It's just a lot of ellipses of him just in his if. But yeah, the first part of the movie, it's just all about, man, I hate Taylor.
Dear Diary, day 6. Taylor will not shut up about my moss-covered statue. I hate him so much. Super hungry. More later.
Only three human beings left in the whole universe, and I want to murder one of them.
I have to say, now, there was the Mego line of Planet of the Apes dolls, and I had some of them because I was a kid in the 70s, and I certainly enjoyed the Planet of the Apes stuff. But, man, Planet of the Apes as a series is a very downbeat series to make toys out of, and there would literally be commercials, you can find them on YouTube, of kids playing Planet of the Apes with Migos, and, like, there are scenes where one kid is playing an ape, and he's like, "Let's vivisect the human," and they're like, "Planet of the Apes by Mego," and you're like, "What?
Yeah,
huh?" Like,
what? That's what you do. Let's geld him. I mean, it's pretty crazy. Where you're basically, you're just like, okay, you be the running, screaming humans, and I'll be basically the ape Dr. Mengele over here with my scalpel, and I'm gonna try to catch you. It's really messed up. I mean, there's five movies, and at best, you get a dark, bittersweet ending that's possibly hopeful for the future.
Yeah.
But every time it's about just crushing your hopes and just grinding them down. I mean, this is a series that one of the endings has the death of all life on Earth. There's one that has a baby shot with a handgun. There's a guy getting, you know, the downfall of human race. I mean, these are the way these movies end, with cities in flames and people's lives being destroyed and their entire, you know, psychic sanity being just shattered. I mean, this isn't like Star Wars. There is no end of one of the Planet of the Apes movies where they're all having, you know, at a ceremony being given medals. That just doesn't happen.
And we can think that the sort of interesting fact about Planet of the Apes is, you know, once Trump is president, we'll be able to see how realistic it is.
Yeah. We want to have another overlord with weird orange hair.
I think that's going to end it here. This is Planet of the Apes. I don't think anybody listening to this has to be told to see it. It's a masterpiece. It's a classic. I was so happy to be able to see it in the theater again. It's just so much fun. It just holds up so perfectly. And it flies by for a movie that's, I don't know, it's a little under 2 hours. I think it's like an hour and 45. Man, it just moves. It, for a movie that has a lot of talking, it just keeps you entertained from beginning to end, right to that last moment. It just never lets up. And it is just, you know, again, Franklin Schaffner deserves, I think, more credit as a director than he gets, because he was on a real roll in the late 60s and 70s. And for any guy that can direct Planet of the Apes and Patton, that's a pretty remarkable career. And again, all props to Charlton Heston, who clearly, you know, at a guy his age, where, I don't know, his career certainly was not on the downward slope, but he was older by that point.
He was like 46, I think,
right,
when he made this.
Right, and by, you know, when you think about what was coming, Easy Rider and all the, you know, the new sort of the new wave of cinema, he was definitely considered old hat. He really took a lot of chances. I mean, he really put himself, I mean, again, he did Soylent Green, he did The Omega Man. I mean, he really threw himself into things that I think a lot of actors at his age would not have done. You know,
yeah, seriously, really, like being in a loincloth from, he's in better shape at 46 than I have ever been in my entire life. But, yeah, you mentioned those two other movies, Soylent Green, The Omega Man. Even if you just take the other Planet of the Apes sequels out of it, I kind of have my own little unofficial trilogy of those three movies as sort of the 1970s downbeat dystopian sci-fi Heston. And I think they really hold up together, watching them all three in a row. And two out of the three have twist endings at the end, too. So they have that in common as well.
Yeah, he's terrific. That's a late career resurgence. And, you know, it's funny, he always seemed very comfortable with it, with his how famous he was. I mean, you know, the man had a whole career of legendary performing the Ten Commandments, for Pete's sakes. But, I mean, he seemed to have a good sense of humor about it. And many years later, I think in the late 90s, he hosted Saturday Night Live. And the whole opening of SNL, they redid all the credits with everyone in ape costumes, as if the world of SNL was done by apes. And so, it was, you know, they're like, Tim Meadows, and he's got an ape costume on. And they literally brought Charlton Heston out in that neck brace thing that they wear. And he's talking about how the world's gone mad. And I thought, that's really cool. Like, he still had a real sense of humor about it and was clearly very proud of Planet of the Apes. And he's into the documentary. But there's a terrific documentary about Planet of the Apes called Behind the Planet of the Apes. It's about Roddy McDowall, which is like 2 hours long. It talks about all the films. It's really, really terrific. So it was kind of nice that he you know, he knew how great it was. And again, all credit to him for helping it get it made, because it wouldn't have been done without him.
Absolutely. And you wonder what science fiction, you know, after it. I mean, it was a big budget budget sci-fi, you know, movie that actually had a toy line. And I wonder if it had an impact on Star Wars 10 years later. Maybe it was easier to get that going because of Planet of the Apes. You never really know. So, yeah. You know, everything touches everything else. And, you know, I'm glad we have the stuff we do. So I love this movie. I love this movie so much.
All right. Well, that's a perfect place to end it. So, Mike, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, I have two podcasts that I team up with my friend Casey Doran for. The first one is Radio versus the Martians, which is a panel discussion show where Casey and I get a couple of our friends together to hash out pop culture topics. We just did an episode on open world video games. We did one on violent vigilante movies like Death Wish and The Punisher before that. And we have another show that we do every other month called Podcasta La Vista, Baby, which is our celebration of the cinematic works of the Governator himself, Arnold Schwarzenegger. We just did an episode on Predator, which is a cinematic classic and is genuinely really, really good. I would recommend checking it out again. We do that every other month. You can catch us on RadioVersusTheMartians.com, PodcastaLaVistaBaby.com, and iTunes, Stitcher, and all the other places you find podcasts.
Excellent. They're both great shows. I enjoy them very, very much. And yes, Predator is really a great movie, and I really enjoy that episode you guys did on Predator. I can't think of Predator now and not think of it having it, those end credits, like the Animal House-style end credits where we'll find out. I can't. That's always going to be lodged in my brain now, so it's perfect. So, yeah, everybody should listen to those shows. They're both really terrific. So, as always, for our show, if you can find it on Twitter, which is at Film & Water Pod, or you can just go to the website, which is filmandwaterpodcast.com. So, Mike, thank you so much for doing the show again. I'm glad we got to talk about Planet of the Apes. A bunch of people wanted to do this movie, but I knew it was your all-time favorite, so I'm really happy you got to come on and talk about it.
Oh, me too. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Help. The human's about to escape.
Get your paws off me, you dirty ape.
He can talk.
He can talk. He can talk. He can talk. He can talk. He can talk. He can talk.
I can sing.
Help me, Dr. Zaius.
Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Oh, Dr. Zaius.
Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius.
What's wrong with me?
I think you're crazy.
Want a second opinion?
You're all so lazy.
Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Oh, Dr. Zaius.
Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius.
Can I play the piano anymore?
Of course you can.
Well, I couldn't before. I hate every ape I see, from chimpanzee to chimpanzee. No, you'll never make a monkey out of me. Oh, my God. I was wrong. It was Earth all along. You finally made a monkey.
Yes, we finally made a monkey.
Yes, you finally made a monkey out of me. I love you, Dr. Zaius.
I wonder where I am. Got to get to a high point to survey the situation.
Capture him!
Oh no, I'm trapped by the apes. What kind of place is this where apes are the ruling class? What are they going to do with me? I must escape.
Smart. We better take care of him. We can't afford to let the human remain a free thinker. We've got to operate.
What are they going to do to me? They're going to operate on me and make me a slave. I've got to help. Gotta run when he looks the other way. Made it!
Get him!
Take that! What strange planet can I be on? Oh, no!